Hello, and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and surrounding villages. This is the news extra edition for the week ending Saturday the 21st of September 2019. My name is Steve and I produce this programme. In this week's programme, we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from the current editions of the Hearts Advertiser and St Albans Review. We'll also have our selection of some interesting national radio programmes coming up in the next week. We then have the second in our new series of interviews, Me and My Job, or rather the second part of the first interview you heard last month. And then, after their summer break, we have another in-concert feature, previewing musical performances coming up in the next few weeks in the local area. This week's music, that bit of ragtime piano you heard, is called The Blackbird, and is by Goffby. But before we begin the programme, we have an announcement. Hearts Vision Loss are running a fundraising curry night at the Ruby Restaurant in Hartford on Thursday the 3rd of October from 7:30pm. The cost is £24, which includes a starter, main course and one side or rice dish. There'll also be a raffle, and all the money raised from the evening will go to support visually impaired people. If you or anyone you know would like to go along, please contact Hearts Vision Loss on 01707 324 680. That's 01707 324 680. Or you can email office@heartsvisionloss.org.uk. And Hearts Vision Loss is all one word. And the address of the Ruby Restaurant is 51 St Andrews Street, Hartford, SG14 1HZ. It's right in the middle of Hartford. So, on with the programme. And our first item is the news. And our readers today are Anna, Marion, Elaine and Jean.
Hello, I'm Anna. My first piece is entitled Council Moves to Ban Illegal Traveller Camps. Travellers could be banned from setting up camp on council land in St Albans. The proposals were considered by St Albans District Council's Planning, Resources, Housing and Commercial Scrutiny Committee to improve the council's response to unauthorised travellers' camps last Thursday. A key recommendation was an investigation into getting an injunction banning camps from council land. This could allow the council to take immediate action to move trespassers on without the need for further court hearings. Other suggested measures included barriers and ditches to protect land and improving communication with the public. Councillor Theresa Heritage, the committee's chairman, said, "We must respect the rights of travellers to move around the country to authorised sites that we and other councils have set aside. However, the rights of farmers and other landowners, along with residents, also need to be upheld. And that means taking appropriate action against unauthorised camps when they occur." Recently, the council asked people across the district if they're receiving enough information and guidance about how traveller incursions are dealt with. The committee debated a report outlining the council's policies for dealing with incursions and how other local authorities operate. Councillor Heritage continued, "The committee recognised that there is a feeling that we are slower than we could be to deal with such incursions. Some councils have obtained a blanket injunction that allows them to act almost immediately, and we've recommended an investigation to see if we should do the same. There have been 5 unauthorised encampments in the district this year, and it's important that when one happens, that people are aware of who they can turn to." The committee agreed to ask Cabinet, the council's decision-making body, to investigate the potential of an injunction to protect its land, as well as providing better perimeter security. And the committee also asked Cabinet to improve communications with the public in the event of an unauthorised camp, including a review of the council's website.
Hello, I'm Marion, and my first article is Hospital Decision to Face Court Review. Campaigners say consultation inadequate. Plans to redevelop hospital services in West Hertfordshire could be scrutinised by the courts after a claim was served for a judicial review. Earlier this year, Harts Valley Clinical Commissioning Group and West Hertfordshire Hospitals Trust formally backed plans to bid for £350 million of NHS funding. As part of that plan, all three hospitals, Watford General, St Albans City and Hemel Hempstead, would be retained and the bulk of the investment would be focused on Watford General. But that went against the preferences of a number of campaign groups which had pushed for the CCG to bid for a new hospital. Now the Harts Valley's CCG has been served with a claim for judicial review on behalf of the new hospital campaign. Judicial review is a legal process to challenge the lawfulness of a public body's decision, action or inaction. It focuses on the way a decision was made and the procedures followed. The challenge will focus on whether or not the CCG made the decisions without holding the required public consultation. Eddie Glatter from the New Hospital Campaign said, "We did not take this action lightly and have done so very reluctantly. The CCG, working with West Harts Hospital Trust, gave us little alternative after they threw out, with almost no backup information, the option of a new hospital on a clear central site accessible to everyone." She continued, "We have always said that unless the new hospital option is fully and fairly considered, the decision-making process can have no credibility. This has not happened, and the consultation must include that option," she said. Campaigners point to their own survey over the summer, to which 96% of 1,500 respondents said the health authorities were not doing enough to involve the public in these decisions. They say there is plenty of opportunity for consultation before the government makes a funding decision. A fundraising campaign has been launched to raise £20,000 for the legal action. A spokesperson for Harts Valley's CCG said it had been served with a claim for a judicial review. Harts Valley's CCG and the West Harts Hospital Trust say legal advice is being sought.
Hello, my name is Elaine and my first article is entitled "Former Saints player is given 14 years for firearms offence." A former St Albans City Football Club player has been jailed for 14 years after trying to give a gun to a dangerous criminal. Top goal scorer Ralston Gabriel and his two identical siblings were found guilty of conspiracy to possess a firearm with intent to endanger life in 2017. They were caught after officers from the Met's Trident and Area Crime Command used intelligence to watch a house in Tottenham's Durban Road on April the 10th that year. They saw a minicab drive up and a man get out, meet another man, load a large holdall and a rucksack into the car, get back in and drive off. Stopping the vehicle, police found an Uzi submachine gun, a self-loading pistol, silencer and ammunition in the bags. Gabriel's DNA was found on the pistol, but because he is one of three identical triplets, it was initially hard to prove which brother was involved. However, extensive inquiries revealed all three Gabriel triplets had a part to play. All 28-year-olds, Reese and Ricky Gabriel, both of Church Street, and Ralston Gabriel of Galahad Road, were sentenced at Blackfriars Crown Court on September the 6th. Ralston and Ricky were given 14 years, and Reese was handed 18 years. Reese was also concurrently sentenced to 6 years, 4 years and 3 years, 6 months for separate charges of firearm possession with intent to endanger life in relation to an incident on the 26th of July 2018 and two counts of possession with intent to supply Class A drugs. Temporary Detective Chief Inspector Dryce Hakune from the Met Specialist Crime Command said, "I am proud of the dedication my officers, notably Detective Sergeant Nick Harvey and Detective Con Irfan Khalifa, showed in tracking down and linking the Gabriel triplets to this case. The trio tried to exploit their identical DNA and appearances to try and evade the consequences of their actions, but the hard work of the investigation team prevented their attempts. Through their actions in this case, these men have thrown away promising careers and futures. As the judge stated at sentencing, these weapons were destined to be used by dangerous criminals. Temporary Detective Chief Inspector Hayukane stressed that an Aaron Thomas, who is making a concerted effort to acquire firearms, is a dangerous individual who intended to cause harm. At the time of this offence, Thomas was on licence from an 11-year sentence for recklessly firing a weapon into a crowd of innocent people. Ralston signed to St Albans City Football Club in summer 2018. He went on to score 4 goals against Chelmsford City in September, helping the team come back from 2-0 down to win 4-2. However, he left the team merely months later. When contacted by the Hearts ad, a St Albans City Football Club spokesman said, "Ralston played for the club for a very short period of time and left the club to rejoin a previous club. We were shocked to hear the news of his conviction a few weeks ago, and as a club are doing our utmost to work tirelessly within the community to use sport and football in particular as a tool to enrich the community for the better."
Hello everyone, this is Jean speaking. And my first item tells of the decision to get rid of some of the art owned by Hertfordshire. The decision to sell off items from the County Council's art collection has been slammed by an influential group of MPs. Hertfordshire County Council took the controversial decision to sell or give away the bulk of its art collection in 2017. Earlier this year, more than 450 works were sold at auction for a collective price of £469,282. The County Council intends to keep around 200 works from its corporate and schools' loan collections, while hundreds more have been, or will be, given away. But members of a cross-party parliamentary group focused on art, craft and design in education say the council's disposal of the works is a major cultural loss. They say legislation surrounding the protection of cultural assets was not adequate in this scenario. They say the council's action have set a worrying procedure for other local authorities' collections. Now they have written to Secretary of State Gavin Williamson in a bid to stop other organisations taking similar action. The letter, signed by Group Chair Sharon Hodgson MP, Co-Chair Tracy Brabin MP and Vice-Chair the Earl of Clancarty, states, "We firmly believe that all children and young people should have as much access to arts as possible, and that the decision will have far-reaching consequences for many years to come. It is wrong to take access to these original artworks away from the audience, which their original purpose was intended for." In the letter, the MPs also questioned the council's decision to retain individual pieces of art, depending on whether they are relevant to Hertfordshire, saying, "We don't expect libraries to only offer material with strong local cultures." They accused the county council of ignoring the advice provided by consultants throughout the process. The MPs from the all-party parliamentary group in art, craft and design estimated that after an auctioneer's fees have been deducted, the sale would have generated just £370,000 for the council. They say that it is equivalent to around 0.046% of the council's annual net budget, which they dismiss as a negligible one-off amount in comparison to the education and cultural loss. Following the auction earlier this year, the Hertfordshire County Council stressed that the funds raised from the sales would be used to improve the condition and visibility of their nationally significant sculptures and other artwork. In response to the comment made by members of the APPG, they stressed the decision relating to the art collection were subject to consultation before any action was taken. Commenting on the ongoing work to find new owners for the artworks, she said the 175 works had already been gifted to educational bodies and local museums, with a further 800 to be given to school museums and community organisations in the coming weeks.
Please stop destroying our heritage from the taxpayer. A heritage campaigner is railing against historical lampposts being unnecessarily removed from the St Albans street scene. David Calocci has campaigned to stop Hertfordshire County Council digging up lighting columns, which he believes are Edwardian in origin, all across the district. He says the most environmentally friendly, cost-effective and heritage-sensitive solution to shabby or broken lampposts is a new lick of paint and electric repair work where necessary, rather than removal. The 50-year-old said, "We are supposed to be an educated country. We are a historic city, and people come here for our history. I have travelled around the world, to China and Canada, and they wouldn't dream of treating their heritage like this. It's crackers. It's totally at odds with national guidelines." David cites Historic England's Streets for All guide, which says lighting should respect local designs, use authentic materials and avoid clutter. One example of what David considers unnecessary work is on Woodstock Road, where HCC has erected a modern lamppost directly beside a historic column with electrical problems. He said, "It turns out they're replacing a structurally sound lamppost because of a fuse, which is wasting a lot of money and losing our heritage. Putting a new lamppost in is totally unneeded and unwanted." David has attached a sign to one lamppost which says, "Please stop destroying our city's heritage," and is signed off from the caring taxpayers of St Albans. A spokesman from HCC said, "Our approach to replacing heritage lighting columns in conservation areas is on a like-for-like basis. However, for heritage lights not in conservation areas, such as Woodstock Road, we can only do this when sufficient funding is available. The particular column in question is structurally sound, but electrically unsafe. For this reason, it was decided to cut the power and install a new column until the feasibility of repairing or replacing the old one is assessed. This ensures electrical safety for the passing public and maintains continuity of light at the location. We will now explore the options open to us and the cost of repairing or replacing the old column. In the meantime, the new column will remain operational until the matter is resolved one way or another."
Plastic Free Initiative taking great strides across district. Drive to reduce the amount of single-use plastic across the district is making an impact, the council says. St Albans District Council has taken action to discourage the use of the environmentally harmful product. They made a commitment earlier this year to banning single-use plastics at council offices, facilities and events. These included the removal of all plastic cups from their offices and a ban on styrofoam from council-run events. Styrofoam has also been largely phased out at St Albans Market, with only one trader still using it, and then only until their current stock runs out. Traders have also been told that they have until the end of this year to use up any supplies they have of single-use plastics. single-use plastics will also be banned from this year's St Albans Food and Drink Street Festival on Sunday, September the 29th. The council's food waste contractor, Veolia, has arranged to meet with local food businesses to discuss options for recyclable food containers at takeaways. An information stall was recently set up at St Albans Market to advise traders on alternatives to single-use plastic and educate the public about how to support the issue in their own homes. It was also recommended that the council should work with its partner organisations, including schools and town and parish councils, on ways to cut down on plastic use. This comes in the wake of the recent Extinction Rebellion clock tower protest, where campaigners said that not enough had been done since the council declared a climate emergency. Councillor Annie Brewster, the chair of the Community, Environment and Sport Scrutiny Committee, said, "I am very impressed by the amount of work that is going on across the city and district to reduce single-use plastics. In particular, the response of our charter market traders has been incredibly positive. On speaking to stallholders, many have already removed or replaced unsuitable products and others are keenly sourcing alternative materials. The gold star must go to the Eat Whole Foods stall. For nearly 24 years, I understand, they have been using cellulose bags for all their products that, unlike normal plastic, break down within 12 months and can be composted in garden bins. They also offer eco-refill facilities for olive oil, shampoo, conditioner, shower gel, hand wash, toilet cleaner, washing up liquid, laundry liquid and fabric conditioner." The Hearts ad spoke to some local reducing plastic campaigning organisations to see what they thought of the council's drive to protect the environment. Plastic Free St Albans campaigner Amanda Yorworth said, "We welcome efforts to reduce the use of single-use plastic, particularly if they encourage their replacement with reusable substitutes. We all own reusable bags now and can already help this along by offering them to market traders when we make our purchase." Plastic Free St Albans is an alliance of local people concerned about their impact on the environment, who are working together to reduce the usage of single-use plastics in St Albans. Emma Snoxall of the Refill Pantry said, "We are thrilled that the council are phasing out single-use plastics in all their offices and street markets. We would urge the council to urgently consider building an industrial composter to process all the compostable alternatives, as these cannot currently be put in any St Albans recycling or green bins, and without this facility, these alternatives to single-use plastic can only be placed in landfill bins."
Teacher shares ways to slow memory loss. A mathematician has shared some of the brain exercises he uses to help people with dementia. Gareth Rowlands from St Albans runs memory workshops at dementia cafes and care homes in Hertfordshire. He became passionate about helping those with memory loss after he visited a care home which his wife ran in Barnet. The retired teacher decided to spend his spare time organising an activity programme for the residents at the care home and began teaching them neurobic exercises he had learned throughout his career. These include using your dominant and then non-dominant hand to write words and draw diagrams, making simple changes to your routine, such as using your non-dominant hand to brush your teeth or to open doors, and drawing a picture while listening to music. Mr. Rowlands said, "Combining two or more senses sends a message to the brain and stimulates it as it realises the challenge of the different routine." He has created a list of 100 neurobic exercises and hopes they will eventually be used by people across the country. Mr. Rowlands said, "There has been ongoing research at King's College in London that says attempting these exercises and training your brain for short periods of time can have many benefits. This includes less stress and positive moods. If you do exercises daily for 10 to 15 minutes for about a month, you can notice a change in your memory. You need to think of your brain as a muscle which needs exercise. The former teacher explained how he came to start his memory workshops. He said it was sad seeing residents at the care home doing nothing at all. The care home invited me to organise an activity programme, and they reaped considerable benefits. I now organise workshops at various venues, including dementia cafes and doctor's surgeries, to help people who are suffering from memory loss. There is a lot to do in terms of helping people, but my mission really is to persevere and leave no stone unturned to help people in the prevention of memory loss. He added, "When I was doing an aerobic session recently at a dementia cafe at Welwyn Garden City, I asked people if they found any benefits from the exercises. They said there was a slight improvement in the memory, were less stressed, they had positive moods, increased motivation and faster thinking." The former teacher passes on his exercises to others in the community, as he believes in their benefits, not just for people suffering from memory loss, but also for everyday memory. He said, "One of my big ambitions is to get this to snowball, to not only spread throughout Hertfordshire and make an impression on the county, but to make a national impact. People can use my ideas to benefit the people who are suffering from memory loss and hopefully be used to catch diseases such as Alzheimer's early."
This next item I found rather sad, but significant. Suicides across Hertfordshire are at the highest level for 16 years, figures have revealed. Data from the Office for National Statistics revealed an increase in the number of suicide cases since 2002, with a total of 103 recorded in the county in 2018, up 27 from the previous year. Within St Albans, the number of suicides in 2018 increased to 14 from 6 the previous year. This is one of the highest numbers in Hertfordshire for 2018. Nationally, the data revealed there were 6,507 suicides registered last year, marking an 11.8% rise from 2017. The figures suggest the rise was largely driven by males, who accounted for 4,903 of the registered deaths in 2018. Ruth Sutherland, chief executive of the Samaritans, said the figures were extremely worrying and called suicide to be considered as a serious public health issue. She continued, "Every single one of these deaths is a tragedy that devastates families, friends and communities. While the overall rise has only been seen this year, and we hope it is not the start of a longer-term trend, it's crucial to have a better understanding of why there has been such an increase." Nick Stripe, Head of Health and Life Events at ONS, added, "We saw a significant increase in the rate of deaths registered as suicide last year, which has changed a trend of continuous decline since 2013. While the exact reasons for this are unknown, the latest data shows that this was driven by an increase among men who have continued to be most at risk of dying from suicide. But Mr. Stripe felt that by looking at the overall trend since the early 1980s, there has been a gradual decline in the rate of suicide for the population as a whole. He added, "We will continue to monitor the recent increase to help inform decision makers and others who are working to protect vulnerable people at risk."
Lecturer travels across the globe to uncover the truth of World War II plane crash. A lecturer's search to uncover the truth about a World War II plane which crashed near his home in the Netherlands has led him almost 400 miles across the world to Radlett. In 2014, Gert Tallens became interested in the mystery of a fighter which caught fire in November 1944 over water which is now the Dutch municipality of Drunten. The 52-year-old was initially tasked with creating a visitor's story for a new forest in Albertweg called Torrensbosie. Gert then discovered that the remains of a de Havilland mosquito which had caught fire and plummeted to the ground over the area had been discovered nearby. Piecing together historical archives, Gert found the two British crew members were navigator Alfred Kitchin and pilot Maurice Williamson. This was at odds with a memorial near the site which said the plane was flying German colours. The aircraft turned out to be one of 290 planes flying to Neuss when it came under fire. Unable to control the blaze, Alfred became trapped in the escape hatch and fell unconscious from smoke inhalation. Maurice was initially luckier. He managed to get out before the aircraft crashed near a local landmark called the Sieberumpen. However, he was promptly captured by German forces and became a prisoner of war. All but the leg of 24-year-old Alfred was pulled from the plane's wreckage and later buried in the Camper Cemetery named Eiselmeissen. In uncovering what happened to these airmen, Gert visited the UK to meet with Alfred's ancestors. He visited Adrian and Simon Kitchin in the Three Horseshoes in Radlett. Gert said, "During my search, I realised more and more that Alfred and Maurice were men who wanted to live. Not heroes, but just guys who lived in a time when things were going badly. They did what they had to do, but would have preferred to do something else." Alfred was posthumously awarded a Distinguished Flying Cross in 1946 for an incident on his third ever outing to occupied territory. He safely guided a battered flight back to safety after its pilot was injured in crossfire over Europe in 1943.
International Boxing Federation world champion packing a punch with boxing taster sessions at City Centre Gym. A two-time International Boxing Federation champion of the world is taking centre stage at a St Albans Leisure Centre this weekend. James DeGale will host free 20-minute boxing technique sessions in a full-size ring at Westminster Lodge Leisure Centre on Saturday, September the 21st. Retiring earlier this year at the age of 33, James brought home both a gold medal at the 2008 Olympics in Beijing and professional world titles during his 10-year career. He bagged the IBF super middleweight belt title in May 2015, lost it in December 2017, but won it back in April 2018. James, who is a gym member of Westminster Lodge, will put participants through their paces in the ring, but also talk about the sport and its fitness benefits, give advice and pose for photos. He will take the child and adult sessions alongside his sister Eloise, who is also a boxing coach. James said, "I feel honoured to be asked to run some boxing taster sessions and I'm looking forward to seeing what talent St Albans has to offer. I suspect I'll have some competition to contend with, especially from younger boys and girls who really love trying out the moves. I better watch out. Boxing drills are fantastic for fitness, discipline and stamina. If you've never tried it before, this open day is a great opportunity to give it a go. I look forward to meeting you ringside." The session is part of the Westminster Lodge Leisure Centre Family Day, which begins at 11 a.m. on Saturday. Other activities include swimming for under fives, face painting and balloon modelling, and wet and wild pool sessions for children over eight. The centre is run by Everyone Active in partnership with St Albans City and District Council. Everyone Active General Manager Leslie Gardner said, "We are delighted that James is offering to host these boxing sessions and can't wait to see some of his expert moves being demonstrated and taught. James trained in the pool here as part of his preparation for professional fights and now he has retired. He also regularly uses our gym. I know people have been itching to see him in boxing action, and members often ask him for advice and tips. Well, now's your chance. All activity sessions can be booked at Westminster Lodge front desk or on 01727 736080. And there's a picture of James De Gale looking extremely fit with his sash and with all the medals and things on the outside.
River Vare protest. Residents concerned about the lack of water in the River Vare are protesting this weekend. The Vare Valley Society are asking people to meet, wearing something blue, at 11:30 at Ye Olde Fighting Cocks on Sunday. Chairman of the Vare Valley Society, John Pritchard, said, "Sunday is World Rivers Day, and we no longer have a river here. The River Vare, our local chalk stream, is no more than a tiny dribble. We are asking people to meet us at Ye Olde and to wear something blue. We want to show the government that this is not an acceptable level of environmental damage in pursuit of public water supply." The Vare Valley Society are a group of over 200 people who want to protect and promote all aspects of the River Vare and its valley. It was founded in 1976 to promote the Vare, but shortly after the river and its valuable water meadows began to decline due to over-abstraction of groundwater and climate change. And there's a picture of the river, and it's just a dribble and loads of sludge.
Well, I too have got a picture here of Anne Main and Bridget Simmons, who is chief executive of the British Beer and Pub Association. And they're holding a bottle between them, which looks as though it hasn't been opened yet. Perhaps it will be later. St Albans MP Anne Main is backing the Long Live the Local campaign to help pubs in the city keep their doors open. In 2018, there were 59 pubs in St Albans, two fewer than in 2017. According to the campaign, the UK is set to lose 10% of its pubs in the next 5 years. Mrs Main is calling on the government to cut beer tax, which has increased by 60% over the past 17 years in the budget. British drinkers now pay 40% of all the beer tax across the European Union, but drink only 12% of the beer. She said, "I'm delighted to continue to support the Long Live the Local campaign, and I'm calling on the Chancellor to cut beer tax at this year's budget to support pubs. Pubs are vital to our local community in St Albans, and I will continue to champion them in Parliament. The government must do more to help businesses like our pubs, which are unfairly impacted by the tax system."
Here's another fitness article. Powerlifting mum selected to squat, deadlift and bench press for England. A St Albans mum of three has been selected to compete for England in a Commonwealth Powerlifting Championship. Ajanta Hilton will travel to Canada later this month to represent England in the Commonwealth Powerlifting Championships as a classic lifter in the Masters category. The 41-year-old only started powerlifting about 2.5 years ago through the training program CrossFit. Before then, she had little experience of working out. At her best, she can now lift 120 kilograms in a squat, 60 kilograms in a bench press, and 140 kilograms in a deadlift. In the competition, her weight from all three lifts is added together to form a score. Ajanta is already making her mark in national competitions, claiming fifth place at the British Masters Classic Championships last October and bronze in the All England Women's Championships 2019 in May. She said, I don't do it professionally. It is sort of a hobby, but I take it quite seriously and I have a coach, Andy Champ, who writes a programme for me. As both a mother and the UK director of a charity based in Sri Lanka called the Rainbow Centre, Ajanta said she never foresaw elite athletic events in her future. I think it just shows what you can do if you really work at something, what you can achieve if you focus, she said. "'Tis a real cliché, but with encouragement and support, you can get there. You can see the weight numbers getting bigger. Not every day goes well. You don't hit your personal best all the time, but it's really empowering to lift something heavy. Ajanta grew up in St Albans, attending Killigrew Primary and Nursery School, and then St Albans High School for Girls. She has encouraged other women to give powerlifting a go. I don't look bulky at all. It's just really good for women, especially as they get older, as muscle mass reduces. I am honestly just delighted to be going. I just really hope to learn more about competing in an international environment. Wherever I come, I will be happy, but I will try my best to get a placement. And she thanked her coach, Andy, and CrossFit St Albans for their support. The Commonwealth Powerlifting Championships was set to start on September the 15th and continue until September the 23rd. And there's a picture of her, oh my goodness, struggling with something that she's trying to lift up.
A charity representative from Harpenden was interviewed on the radio to raise awareness of blood cancer. The director of Lymphoma Action, Stephen Scowcroft, was asked to come on BBC Somerset because it is Blood Cancer Awareness Month in September. He spoke about the symptoms of lymphoma, which is the fifth most common type of cancer in the UK. Stephen said, we would encourage anyone with symptoms that they are concerned about to visit their GP. These can include fatigue, night sweats, unexplained weight loss, and constant itching for no reason. Hodgkin lymphoma sufferer Megan Bassett was also interviewed alongside Stephen. She is part of a Make Blood Cancer Visible campaign running through Blood Cancer Awareness Month.
Extraordinary women receive honorary doctorates. Two pioneering St Albans women have been awarded honorary doctorates from the University of Hertfordshire. Dame Mary Richardson and Funke Mbimbola were celebrated in ceremonies at St Albans Cathedral for their extraordinary contributions in their respective fields. Funke was honoured for her work in corporate and social diversity, and Dame Mary for her work in education. Beginning her career as a corporate lawyer in London 19 years ago, and as a black woman of Nigerian descent, Funke came across both racism and gender discrimination. She was not deterred, however, and thanks to her determination, she managed to achieve places in a number of law firms, including her first role at Wembley PLC. In 2012, she joined Roach UK in Welwyn Garden City as managing counsel and later became the most senior black solicitor within the company. She went on to be general counsel at Roach UK and is currently general counsel at Cycle Pharmaceuticals in Cambridge. Funke has managed to support her full-time career as a senior lawyer, while also voluntarily working towards the promotion of diversity in the workplace. Her many accolades include a Point of Light, given by then Prime Minister Theresa May in 2016, and an MBE in 2017 for her services to diversity in the legal profession and to young people. The University of Hertfordshire's Honorary Doctorate is her next award. Funke said, I am deeply humbled by this incredible recognition, and it is a real privilege. My voluntary work in improving diversity within the legal profession is far from easy and has required a tremendous amount of resilience and personal sacrifice. Dame Mary, formerly Chief Executive of HSBC Global Education Trust, has had an extensive and successful career in education and worked with young people for most of her life. She graduated and qualified at the University of Liverpool before training as an officer in the Women's Royal Army Corps. First teaching at St Adrian's Catholic Primary School and what is now Marlborough Science Academy in St Albans, Dame Mary later took the role as head teacher of a secondary school in an underprivileged area of Brent from 1985 to 1999. She revolutionised the school by implementing IT and music facilities, and under her leadership, the languages department was awarded specialist status. Her reforms as head teacher saw a 53% increase from 8% to 61% in the number of students achieving five or more GCSEs at A star to C. By 1999, multiple pupils were accepted to Oxbridge each year. Dame Mary saw continued success with her subsequent move to HSBC Global Education Trust as the chief executive. She ran and established the trust that worked to support children living on the streets, in orphanages, and in care in the UK and across the world. Since then, she has continued her career as a governor in three schools and a university, and is a found ambassador of Teach First, a charity aiming to improve education in young people across England and Wales. She was awarded her DBE in 1999 for her services to education.
Well, I have a picture of somebody's pet and the happiness of their family. A family say they're over the moon after their stolen dog was tracked down in Birmingham. Harmony, a three-legged Staffordshire Bull Terrier, was snatched from outside Tesco Metro in St Peter Street, St Albans, after she was left outside by owner Colin French on September the 10th. Mr. French's sister, Katie Corley, issued a desperate appeal on Facebook to find Harmony, who had been left tied up outside the shop. This post was shared by thousands of times as police launched a hunt to find Harmony, and there were reported sightings in St Albans at Watford Junction. Katie confirmed that Harmony, who was rescued by her owner, Colin French, more than 6 years ago, was found by officers in Birmingham on Friday. In a post on Facebook, she wrote, "Reunited. Police recovered Harmony from a location today, and now my brother has his best friend back. Thank you all for your share and support. Special thanks to the Dog Lost team and the police, without whom we would not have been able to do it. Please share on my behalf. We are over the moon." Dog Lost Hertfordshire, which helped research for Harmony, said, "We have such good news. She's been found and reunited in Birmingham. Fantastic support and information behind the scenes meant that the police had details that led them to Birmingham. They seized her, and now Colin is reunited with his beautiful girl. Thank you everyone who shared and followed and gave information, and to Hertfordshire British Transport Police and West Midlands Force too. It is unknown whether the person who stole Harmony was found by the police."
And that's the end of the news. And now, the list of people whose deaths were announced in this week's edition of the Hearts Advertiser. Mabel Brett. Geoffrey Bullimore, aged 87 years. Tom Carter, aged 96. Frederick Croft, aged 102. David Cheetham, MBE, aged 78. Peter Inky England. Dominic Francisco Hemming, aged 25. Janet Herbert, aged 88. Keith John, aged 68. Barry Mercer, aged 83, and Rodney Palmer, aged 86. Now, some more of our musical offering, and then we'll have our selection of national radio highlights for the next few days.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday the 21st of September. And at 10:30 a.m. on Radio 4 is the last in the series My Dream Dinner Party, this week featuring comedian John Cleese's guest choices. Writer and philosopher Aldous Huxley, actress Betty Davis, comedian Spike Milligan, filmmaker Susan Sontag and neurologist Oliver Sacks. Then on Radio 3 at 5 p.m, Opera on Three returns with Andrew Davis conducting the Royal Scottish National Orchestra in Wagner's Götterdämmerung, recorded at the close of this year's Edinburgh Festival. Finally, for Saturday the 21st at 8 p.m. on Radio 4, Archive on Four this week is entitled Panorama Broke My School. In 1977, Shabnam Gruel was a pupil at Faraday School in West London when a panorama team filmed there, with disastrous consequences. Now a BBC journalist herself, she tracks down those involved with the programme at the time, both the filmmakers and the teachers and the pupils.
On to Sunday the 22nd of September, and a new series of Desert Island Discs at 11:15 a.m. on Radio 4. Lauren Laverne's Castaway this week is the frontman and vocalist of rock band Radiohead, Tom York. Repeated on Friday the 27th of September at 9 a.m. Drama at 3 p.m. on Radio 4 is entitled Master of the Mint by David Ashton. 17th century scientific genius Isaac Newton takes on a new post at the Royal Mint in the Tower of London and soon finds himself in pursuit of a counterfeiting gang. But can he catch the ringleaders before their criminal plans trigger a huge financial crash that threatens to topple the government? Fans of Celine Dion will be keen to tune in to Radio 2 at 5 p.m. for Celine Dion from A to Z, a chance to hear many of her hits, plus a candid interview with the Quebec born superstar. Finally, for Sunday the 22nd of September, with the Rugby World Cup having kicked off yesterday, today the home nations take to the field. You can hear Ireland v Scotland at 8 p.m. and then England v Tonga at 10:45 p.m. both on Radio 5.
And now for a look at some of those programmes which are broadcast each day, Monday to Friday, at the same time. Book of the Week, each day at 9:45 a.m. on Radio 4, is Who Am I Again? Comedian Lenny Henry tells the story of his early years and rise to fame and starts by reflecting on one of his biggest inspirations, his mother. Repeated at 12:30 at night. The 15-minute drama at 10:45 a.m. each day on Radio 4 is Just a Woman. Amy is a typical modern 18-year-old who happens to be transgender. She is packing for a trip to Amsterdam with new best friend Rachel, while her family tries to stay calm but without succeeding. Repeated at 7:45 p.m. each evening. Composer of the Week on Radio 3 at 12 noon is Gustav Mahler. Donald MacLeod explores the music and life of the composer, beginning with the impact of his love for his wife, Alma Schindler. On Radio 4, also at 12 noon each day this week, is the continuation of Margaret Atwood's The Testaments, the sequel to The Handmaid's Tale, published 15 years earlier. Then at 10:45pm each night on Radio 3 is the essay Beyond Borders, which features five writers exploring the theme of boundaries. First up is Irish writer Sinead Gleeson on the subject of physical pain.
And now some recommendations for Monday, the 23rd of September. The Rugby World Cup continues, and today it's the turn of Wales, who play Georgia. Tune in to Radio 5 at 11am. Also at 11am on Radio 4, The Deported. The stories of three people removed or deported from the UK to Nigeria, a country they left many years ago. Fola was forced to leave after her marriage to a British man broke down. Shams was deported after serving a prison sentence, and Jessica, having arrived as a student 13 years earlier, was removed when she was unable to extend her visa. Then, at 4:05 in the afternoon, also on Radio 4, is Street City Goodbye, in which music and sound are used to celebrate the disappearing cries of street vendors, past and present. This is followed at 4:30pm by The Infinite Monkey Cage. Brian Cox and Robin Ince this week look at animal intelligence.
On Tuesday, the 24th of September, and the drama at 2:15pm on Radio 4 today is Lamanby, Jacob Poley's play, is an extraordinary account of a childhood house that is about to be sold. A man returns to spend a final night there and begins to experience strange, powerful dreams. At 4pm, also on Radio 4, is The Syrians and the Kinder Transport Kids, in which four new and old refugees meet and compare experiences. They all miss the countries they left behind, but at the same time, they love their new home and are determined to make a life for themselves and their families. Then at 6:30pm, the comedy Claire in the Community returns for a final series. This week, Brian falls seriously ill, but Claire has little sympathy. Finally, for Tuesday, 24th of September, over to Radio 3 for Free Thinking at 10pm. This week marks the 70th anniversary of the film of The Third Man, and the programme visits the archives of the British Film Institute with Angela Allen, the script supervisor for the film. Plus the retracing of an investigation by Stieg Larsson, author of the Millennium Trilogy of crime novels, into the unsolved assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olaf Palme in 1986.
We come now to Wednesday, the 25th of September. And at 2:15pm on Radio 4 is Brief Lives, the drama in which a team of legal advisers help the people of Manchester who have run into trouble with the law. This week, Frank and Sarah come across a teenager who has been beaten up. But is there something more sinister afoot? Then at 4pm on Radio 4 is Am I Too Old to Drive? Journalist Julia Langdon was so concerned about her elderly father's driving that she reported him to the DVLA. Now a septuagenarian herself, she asks if we need to change the law and force the over 70s to have their driving assessed officially.
On to Thursday, the 26th of September. Classic book enthusiasts may want to tune into Radio 4 Extra at 10am for a two-part dramatisation of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. The second part is at the same time the next day, Friday the 27th of September. The Art of Now, Harlem's New Renaissance, is at 11:30am on Radio 4. This is a look back at an explosion of African-American culture. It began in 1919 with the Great Migration that brought many people from the southern states of America north to the urban areas, where their culture flourished and Haarlem became a centre for artistic endeavour. Then at 3 p.m. on Radio 4, you can hear Ramblings, in which this week Claire Boarding climbs Cleeve Hill near Cheltenham. She is joined by Chaz and Sue Howes, who discuss how walking and running on the hill have improved their mental and physical health. Repeated on Saturday at 6:07 a.m.
Finally to Friday, the 27th of September. And the drama at 2:15 p.m. is The Changeling Self. Tam returned to the Edinburgh Festival in search of the woman he loved and lost. He travels through the city retracing their past, losing himself in the memories. Then over to Radio 2 for Friday night is Music Night. It is 50 years since the release of the Beatles' long player Abbey Road. To celebrate, the BBC Concert Orchestra performs arrangements of Beatle music by George Martin. Recorded in London's Abbey Road studio, the concert features singer Kerris Matthews, Katie Melua, Ruby Turner, and the London Contemporary Voices.
And now for the second in our new series of interviews, Me and My Job. This week, continuing from last month, we have the second part of Rob Pearman's interview with television journalist Martine Croxall.
Some of what you do is literally the news. Others is where you're interviewing people in the studio. And
yes, or down the line, as we call them. Yeah, details down the line.
I was thinking for the moment of what the papers say. We might have a couple of journalists or other experts talking about what's in the papers that day. You're having to wing that a bit, aren't you?
That's not scripted. Other than we do a quick rundown of what's on the front pages of the newspapers, which we call the stack, and that's where we flip through the graphicised front pages. And they're not actually there. It's called augmented reality graphics. And I turn to look at them, but they're not there. And then they appear on television thanks to the graphic system that we have. But then I have, as you say, two guests, usually journalists, because they have to be able to talk about any subject under the sun. And they've usually come in an hour or so before we go on air at 10:30 and 11:30 to have a look through the papers, to choose the stories. And usually I have read the front pages, but often it's a rather cursory glance. And so it's my job to steer them through the 6 or 7 pages that we've got and that we've chosen.
And there's a time limit?
Yes.
You know how long?
12 to 15 minutes. Sometimes, if we're lucky, we'll do a longer version. So particularly around the Brexit story, sometimes there are some momentous days that require longer for you to sort of pore over the papers. But that's great fun, because for me, the unscripted output, you don't know where it's going to go. It's also the end of the day. You're looking ahead to what the papers are going to be reporting on the next morning. And you've got a bit of leg room to have some fun with it, because it is most news, isn't it? It's pretty grim. And it's just nice to have a bit of levity. Somebody asked me, I did an interview, an event a few months back at St Albans Boys School, where it was the politics students, and they asked me a lot of questions. And the one question that I'd never been asked before was, what's the most important thing to get right? And I don't think I've ever been asked that before. And for me, it's tone. Because if your tone's wrong and you sound flippant, or you're making in-jokes that exclude the viewer, that doesn't go down well, quite understandably. And I just think tone is the most important thing. So although we have a bit of fun on the papers, and I hope it comes across that I enjoy my job, because I certainly do, and I think it's a huge privilege to do it, as long as you get your tone right, in the right places, you can have a bit of fun with it.
It's said with radio that you need to think that you're talking to a person.
That's what I was told.
Is that what you do on television?
Yes. Yes, I do. Alistair Stewart on ITV News was asked on social media recently, well, we were both asked, who do you think of when you broadcast? And Alistair said, a family of four, which is very Alistair. And I said, an intelligent acquaintance. So it's someone who you know a little bit, but you're not overly familiar like your best friend. And it's someone who is smart, is switched on, is interested in the news. In some cases, will know more than you do about subjects. And so that helps me, I hope, pitch things at the right level.
You have to be aware of a lot of different things. You don't have to have in-depth knowledge of a lot of different things, other than, I guess, at the moment, politics, because politics is so dominant. But do you read a lot? Do you think, do you have time to read around? I mean, you read 12 papers a day?
No, well, I read bits and pieces of lots of different things. And I remember a long time ago when I worked in local radio, we were told there is no right paper to read. There's no wrong paper to read. Your listeners will be reading a range of different newspapers, so it's a good idea to read a range of different views. And a lot of the stuff that I read now is online. I've subscribed to online newspapers, and I read a lot of long reads that I would never have come across before because social media takes you to those places. And I find that has sort of broadened my reading in some ways. And I know it's difficult for newspapers because they're competing with all of that and they're trying to find a model whereby they can be online and still make a profit. I just also make myself follow people on social media who I don't agree with. Or otherwise, you create this little bubble, an echo chamber for yourself. And it's really good to be challenged all the time.
It's like if you only read The Guardian or you only read The Mail, you're getting two completely different worldviews.
Yes, and people tend to read the newspaper that supports their view in the first place. And of course, as you know, I'm not allowed to express an opinion on the BBC, and I hope that I don't. And it also, doing this job, it does make you see the different sides. You're like, well, I can see on the one hand, but I can see on the other. And so you almost find it difficult to express an opinion sometimes in the end because you get so used to not doing so.
You obviously enjoy what you do. What's the best type of television that you do? Do you want to do other things?
Well, yeah, I'd whatever they'd like to offer me, really. But I recently, which was a total departure for me, I was on the red carpet at the BAFTAs at the Royal Albert Hall. And I hadn't done that before. And it was supposed to be an hour and a quarter of live broadcasting. And again, we had no script. We had no real structure because you don't know who's coming down the red carpet. I had two guests, Jason Solomons, a film critic who could talk about every film that was nominated, and Maria Grashvogel, who is a fashion designer, and she was able to talk about all of the wonderful gowns that the women in particular were wearing, although there were quite a few men who veered away from the usual, you know, black tie this year. And in the end, we were on air for an extra half an hour because we were waiting for the royals to arrive, William and Kate, and they were running late, so it meant we stayed on air. And we did an hour and three quarters, unscripted, no auto cue, and it was wonderful. You fling yourself on air, you kind of know where you're going, and you're making it up as you go along. And Lizo Mazimba, who is our entertainment correspondent, was on the red carpet. We were handing to him when he was, you know, talking to Olivia Colman or Bill Nighy or whoever. And he spoke to a lot of the really big name stars. And we made, apparently, what was a very nice programme. And I'd never done it before and I loved it. So live TV takes a lot of beating. And for me, it feels like a very safe space. I suppose because I've been doing it such a long time. It's almost like my living room now, the studio I'm in. And that's how I think and hope we're able to be quite sort of relaxed and conversational about it, given the fact you are constrained by the grammar of TV news.
Mm-hmm. You're not tempted to go and make documentaries? You've got the production experience, you've got the writing, you've got a fairly good skill set.
Yes, I've made a few radio documentaries. I think the problem with doing live news is you love the immediacy and the urgency of it. And so documentaries which take quite a long time to make, I'm not sure I've got the patience. It's a very different approach to have. But yeah, I've got some ideas of things that I'd like to make. But it's just a case of finding the right commissioning editor, because the commissioning process can be a bit of a mystery.
When I was young, newsreaders were all men.
And they sounded very different from me, because I am conscious that I do have a regional accent, and to a lot of people in Hertfordshire, I will sound very northern, probably.
I wouldn't think so. I was thinking of the various comments made that, you know, when we moved on from the men who used to sit there in their dinner jackets, as it were, reading the news. There are a lot more women in now than there were before, aren't there?
There are.
People like me don't even notice whether you're looking at them, as it were.
No, I'm glad about that, because I think you've really got somewhere when you stop noticing that somebody is different, as
even
they
though described. The viewer is aware that the man can turn up in a suit and the woman has to think what she dresses in.
Yes, I think it was a newsreader in New Zealand who deliberately wore the same suit for a whole year and nobody noticed, whereas of course if I wore the same dress 2 days on the trot, somebody would notice. Yeah, it is a peculiar thing, because the question I get asked most often is, do they do your hair and makeup? when I'd rather be asked about how do you approach an interview. But it's a consideration. TV is a visual medium. You need to look the part. Nothing about you needs to stand out. You know, you don't want your hair sticking up on end. Your jewellery needs to be sort of symmetrical. You don't want dangly earrings that are distracting. So it's about looking professional without there being anything that stands out too much.
But also maintaining that relationship with the viewer, which is what you talked about earlier, where you're thinking that you're talking to somebody.
Yeah, that was one of the first things I was ever taught when I went into broadcasting, is that you don't listen as a group. You listen and watch as an individual. And that comes down to things like, I was taught, don't say, hello, everyone. Just say hello. And also don't say things like, oh, you've written into us. Well, no, I haven't. Viewers have written into us, they've texted us or whatever. So I'm quite careful about, maybe I'm a bit old fashioned, I don't know, because some of these conventions seem to fall by the wayside a bit. But I like to be talked to as an individual. And that's where the best broadcasters get it right for me. And so that's what I'm aiming for, really. But the BBC has got a project called 50-50. We're trying to make sure that we've got a 50% split between male and female contributors. We're getting there. Mm. You know, it's a cultural change, and it's just reminding yourself as a producer to think differently, to try and invite different voices onto the output.
Women are going into aspects of broadcasting where they wouldn't go before. I mean, I'm thinking of the foreign correspondents that go into war zones. I know it faces as much danger as any reporter has ever
faced.
Yeah,
why shouldn't they? Yeah, I mean, there's a long history of women as war correspondents. Martha Gellhorn, of course, who was married to Ernest Hemingway, is the one that immediately springs to mind. But some of our finest correspondents, I'm thinking of Lise Doucette or Le Guerin, they go everywhere and face the same dangers that their male colleagues would face.
And the fact that we have changed significantly, we've still got a way to go. You say the 50-50 is a project, you haven't got there yet. That will go on. What's the next thing for television news? How far the social media are not undermining it, but presenting challenges to the news all the time, because you're trying to present not fake news, but real news.
Yes.
And you're surrounded by potentially fake news coming in from other sources, and we're trying to pick our way through all this. Where are we going next?
Well, we have a team called Reality Check who will get hold of a subject around which there is confusion, or there is disinformation, or there's received wisdom, and you go to town and you do a proper journalist job. And you pick up the phone and you speak to experts, or you get facts verified. And Reality Check is just proper journalism, checking that you've got the right version of events. And of course, that doesn't mean that opinions around that subject won't differ. Of course they will. And we need to try and reflect, not extreme views, but we need to try and reflect a broad church.
We're in difficult times because a lot of people are obsessed with conspiracies. Everything is a conspiracy. Everybody's always attacked the BBC. The left attacks BBC for being right-wing. The right-wing attacks BBC for being left-wing. So you must be doing something right in the middle.
Let's hope so.
It's probably true that those who are looking for a certain, as you mentioned with newspapers, those who are looking for a certain sort of truth will not necessarily look at television news. They'll go to certain social media which fulfil their wishes and fantasies.
Yeah, and the BBC is very aware that habits are changing and people have a choice about how and where they get their news from. And it is a challenge. And we are seeing a bit of an erosion in viewing figures, but we still have respectable viewing figures. And this is where the BBC recognises that if it wants to attract a broad range of audience, we have to have a broad range of output and programmes that will appeal to everybody. And you can't please everyone all the time, but we're going to try.
Just going back right to the beginning, you took a traditional route through from what was traditional, I don't know if it still is, which is local radio station, getting work experience, then going into a local television, then into the national television and global television and so on. Is that still available? Is that route still available?
Yes, it is. A lot of people tend to do an undergraduate degree, and I think the best newsrooms are populated by people with degrees in all sorts of different subjects. So you've got experts in economics and politics and history and the arts, even, you know, the sciences. Science journalism is very difficult to do well. A lot of people then go on and do a postgraduate diploma, which is a one-year course usually, which teaches you the skills of broadcasting, editing and interviewing. And then the BBC runs highly, highly contested, very competitive training courses. He's also, in the last few years, has started to introduce digital journalism apprenticeships to try to attract people who haven't necessarily been to university. I went and talked to a group of them at the BBC's training centre at Wood Norton in the Vale of Evesham a couple of years ago, and they were all in their late teens, early 20s, none had been to university, and they were from very diverse backgrounds. One had been working in a chip shop, one had been working in a garden centre, another one had been unemployed. But these were young people who had really brilliant storytelling skills in digital form. So they were bloggers and vloggers, and they could write really well for the website. They were also taught radio and television as well, so that they understood how all the different types of journalism within the BBC fit together. And that's proved to be very popular, because we're trying to reach people who don't think necessarily that the BBC is the kind of place where they would work, if they feel that they don't see and hear people who are like them on radio and television. And it's trying to change that.
Martin, we've, as they don't say in television, we've run out of time.
Well, you're not meant to say that.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
And now, in concert, Jill Burridge talks to David Eyerson about the musical performances coming up in the area in the next few weeks.
Hello again. It's Jill Burridge here, and I'm joined by David Eyerson, and we're going to have a look ahead to some of the concerts and recitals that are coming up over the weeks ahead. So, David, let's start us off with the 28th of September, the Amadeus Chamber Orchestra performing.
Hello, yes. The season starts with a month of mainly orchestral concerts and a focus in some of them on the sea. The first major concert this season is given by the Amadeus Chamber Orchestra in St Saviour's Church and features Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, No. 3, the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto and Arvo Pärt's Cantus in Memoriam Benjamin Britten. This was written in 1977 by the Estonian composer Arvo Pärt, and he set it for string orchestra and a bell, and it mourns the death in 1976 of Benjamin Britten, whom Pärt regarded as a kindred spirit and very much wanted to meet, though he never did. It is perhaps his most popular piece, lasts about 7 minutes. Its appeal is often linked to its apparent simplicity with a single melody, but it is in fact a rather more complex piece. It's often used in film and television documentaries. This is followed then by Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto with Alexandra Peel as the soloist. She was a finalist in the Purcell School Concerto competition, and the orchestra Amadeus has a great reputation for giving platforms to up-and-coming young soloists. The Violin Concerto is one of Mendelssohn's most popular works. He originally proposed the idea to Ferdinand David, who was then the concertmaster of the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. Conceived in 1838, the work took another 6 years to complete and wasn't premiered until 1845. During this time, Mendelssohn maintained a regular correspondence with David, who gave him many suggestions. The work was one of the foremost compositions of the Romantic era and had considerable influence on other composers. The concerto was very well received and became regarded as one of the greatest violin concertos of all time. Now, Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, No. 3 in E-flat, came at the beginning of what has come to be known as Beethoven's middle period, when he was beginning to go deaf. Written in 1803-1804, it was first performed in Vienna in 1805. It's probably twice the length of a classical symphony, and has, of course, a famous funeral march. You may know the story about its dedication. It was originally dedicated to Napoleon Bonaparte, who Beethoven thought embodied the democratic and anti-monarchical ideals of the French Revolution. However, in the autumn of 1804, he withdrew the dedication to Napoleon Bonaparte in case it cost him the composer's fee, which was due to be paid to him by a noble patron. He rededicated the symphony to Prince Joseph Franz Maximilian Lobkowitz and titled it Bonaparte. Beethoven was delighted that Napoleon had called himself the first consul, which made Beethoven think of ancient Rome. However, when Napoleon proclaimed himself the Emperor of Europe, Beethoven flew into a rage and tore up the title page, renaming the symphony Eroica, or Heroic. Anyway, what I've always found much more interesting about the symphony, however, is the very first line of it, where Beethoven takes a significant step forward in the development of music. He He's sometimes described as bestriding the worlds of classicism and romanticism like a colossus, and this is certainly one of those moments where he crosses that bridge. The symphony starts straightforwardly in E-flat major with two big chords, and then the cellos play the tune, which goes dee-da-da-dee-da-da-da-dee, so you think quite straightforward. But as early as bar 7, he rather goes off-piste with a C-sharp, which in the key of E-flat major is sort of completely foreign. This note would never have occurred in a classical symphony, which would have kept to the notes of the scale of the home key. Anyway, it's much better to hear the proper thing. So here is the beginning of the Eroica Symphony.
Very well known, the beginning of the Eroica Symphony by Beethoven, and that's part of the concert that's taking place on Saturday the 28th of September, the Amadeus Chamber Orchestra performing, and they'll be at St Saviour's Church in St Albans, and the concert starts at 7:30. Now, Wednesday is just a reminder. I think we've mentioned these lunchtime concerts before, but they're starting up a new season again, aren't they?
Yeah.
Mostly held in St Peter's Church.
All held in
St Peter's Church.
1 o'clock on a Wednesday.
Yep.
And they all last about an hour, no longer than that, and there is refreshments afterwards in the Octagon.
You don't need a ticket or anything.
No, you just turn up. Just turn up. They've got some rather interesting things this month. On Wednesday, the 25th of September, Josef Puritz is going to play the classical accordion. The following Wednesday, the 2nd of October, the Tanzer Ensemble. The following Wednesday, the 9th of October, Sandringham School will bring some young musicians. The following Wednesday, the 16th of October, St Albans High School for Girls, the same. And on Wednesday, the 23rd of October, Beaumont School will provide some musicians. So 3 weeks of youngsters making music, which I always find very well worth listening to. And to round the couple of months up, Wednesday the 30th of October is the Icknield Trio, which is local players. I think the trio is violin, cello and piano, I think, but I'm not absolutely certain.
Okay, so that's Wednesdays, starting 25th of September, 1 o'clock,
yep,
at St Peter's Church, and you can just turn up. So it's quite a nice little sort of interlude in the middle of the day.
Absolutely.
Oh, right. So let's move on now to the beginning of October. Saturday, the 5th of October, Carry On Chamber Choir are performing again at St Saviour's Church in St Albans. Interesting programme, this. This is sort of Bach and other things too.
Yes. Their first concert of the season, Bach and Rheinberger. They're going to sing three of Bach's six motets, Lobet den Herrn, Praise the Lord, Komm Jesu komm, Come Jesus come, and Singet dem Herrn, Ein neues Lied, Sing unto the Lord a new song. These pieces were written when Bach was at Leipzig, and it has been suggested that Bach wrote Singet dem Herrn as a training exercise for his young singers. It's certainly a challenging and fast-moving piece and makes technical demands on the singers, as you'll see from this short extract from the beginning of it. Komm Jesu komm was probably written for a funeral and would certainly have entertained the mourners. These motets were the only pieces of Bach's choral music that were regularly in the repertoire from his death until 1750 up to the time of the Bach revival, which was of course led by Mendelssohn in the 19th century. They are all very listenable to, full of melody, counterpoint and interesting harmony, as of course you would expect from the great Bach. Also in the programme is the Mass in E-flat by Josef Rheinberger, one of the few romantic settings of the Mass, and like the Bach motet, it uses eight parts, which is the choir divided into two separate choirs. Rheinberger was born in 1839 in Liechtenstein, and his father actually was the Prince of Liechtenstein's treasurer. But he had such precocious musical talent that he was appointed to his first post as an organist at the age of 7.
Good Lord.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. My word. In 1851, he moved to Munich, where he stayed for the rest of his life. He became conductor of the Munich Choral Society and professor at the conservatory. He wrote a lot of organ music, but this mass is lovely to sing and rewarding to listen to with its great sweeps of melodic invention and marked contrasts of mood. Here is the start of the Gloria.
So part of the Gloria from Rheinberger's Mass. Not a work that I'm at all familiar with.
No, it's not often done in concert. We do it in the cathedral, actually. It's in the cathedral repertoire, and we have recorded it. But it's a lovely piece. The concert also features Bach's first cello suite, played on a Baroque cello by Nikolai Ginoff. Bach wrote 6 cello suites, like the motets, and they are remarkable in that they sound like there is more than one instrument playing, and they're brilliantly written for the cello. They all start with a prelude and then have a number of movements based around Baroque dances. The first suite in particular is very popular and is often again used by television and filmmakers. The cello will also play the continuo bass line in the Bach motets.
So that's the Carillon Chamber Choir doing that concert of Bach and Rheinberger, and it's at St Saviour's Church in St Albans on Saturday the 5th of October, starting at 7:30. The following evening, Sunday the 6th of October, over in Hatfield, the de Havilland Philharmonic are performing at the Western Auditorium, which is part of the university complex in Hatfield. They're doing a golden anniversary concert. Whose golden anniversary is it?
Well, theirs. Their own golden anniversary.
Oh, well done.
And as you would expect, it's full of orchestral favourites and shows off the orchestra and its conductor, Robert Browning. They start with Rachmaninoff's symphonic poem, The Isle of the Dead. This was inspired by Rachmaninoff seeing a black and white reproduction of Arnold Böcklin's painting, The Isle of the Dead. He later, funnily enough, saw the original and said that if he had seen this first, he probably wouldn't have written the piece because he preferred it in black and white. It starts with the sound of oars in the water and quotes from the plain chant melody from the funeral service, the Dies Irae. And they follow this with Ravel's Pavane for a Dead Infanta. A pavane is a slow dance which enjoyed great popularity in the courts of Europe throughout the 16th and 17th centuries, and this piece, Pavane, is considered one of his masterpieces. The mood then brightens up somewhat with Rimsky-Korsakov's Le Coq d'Or, The Golden Cockerel, an orchestral suite lasting around 25 minutes. It was originally written as an opera, but the orchestral suite is more often performed. It begins with a high trumpet call, perhaps the cockerel, and is full of orchestral colour and is a great piece to show off the de Havilland Phil on their golden anniversary. They finish the concert with Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony, one of the greatest of all the Russian Romantic works. It was first performed in St Petersburg in 1908. At the time, Rachmaninoff had enjoyed 2 successful seasons at the Bolshoi Theatre, but considered that his schedule was getting in the way of his composing, which he thought of as the most important part of his career. He therefore moved with his family to Dresden, which meant that, one, he could spend more time composing, but also meant that he could escape the political tumult which would put Russia on the path to revolution. The Second Symphony was written at around the same time as The Isle of the Dead, which started the programme. His First Symphony had met with mixed reviews, and this had caused him somewhat to doubt his talent. But the Second Piano Concerto and the Second Symphony were great successes and restored Rachmaninoff's confidence. It is undoubtedly one of the great Russian Romantic works, and some of its ideas have been used by songwriters, jazz musicians, and of course filmmakers. If you like the sound of an orchestra enjoying itself, you will love this piece, Rachmaninoff at his most melodic, colourful, and of course romantic. Here's a bit of the third movement.
It is very lush, isn't it?
It is.
So that's the concert on the 6th of October, Sunday the 6th of October, the de Havilland Philharmonic celebrating their golden anniversary at the Western Auditorium in Hatfield as part of the university complex there. Starts at 7:30. Then Saturday, October the 12th, there is quite a lineup for this St Cecilia Festival Chorus at the Cathedral in St Albans.
Yes.
Starting at 7:30. I mean, goodness me, how many choirs have we got?
Well, the St Cecilia Festival happens every other year. and this is one of the years. And the festival chorus is made up of St Albans Chamber Choir, the Harding Choir, the Radlett Choral Society, a massed children's choir from across Hertfordshire, and on this occasion by Vivamus, a small London-based chamber choir whose regular conductor is Rufus Froud, who also conducts the Harding Choir and is conducting this concert.
Right.
So quite a cast list.
It is.
The programme is celebratory and maritime. The evening starts with Britain's Fanfare for St Edmundsbury. This is a piece for three trumpets, which Britain wrote for a pageant of Magna Carta, which took place in the grounds of St Edmundsbury Cathedral in 1959. The orchestra will then perform two of the sea interludes, Dawn and Sunday Morning. These are fantastically atmospheric pieces and are often played in concert and are ideal for this one, obviously, which also features Jonathan Dove's three seaside postcards. I love Jonathan Dove's music. It's always tuneful, rhythmically interesting, and there is no doubt that he has a unique voice in the English music of today. The concert finishes with Vaughan Williams' great Sea Symphony. The choirs sing the words of the American poet Walt Whitman, and this is Vaughan Williams' first and longest symphony. It's a wonderful work with much variety of mood as the sea itself, and provides a fitting climax to what should be a splendid concert. Here is the very beginning of the first movement.
Wonderful start to Vaughan Williams' Sea Symphony, which will be part of the concert given in the Cathedral, St Albans Cathedral, 7:30 on Saturday, October the 12th, to celebrate St Cecilia Festival. Then we move to the following Saturday, 19th of October. The Harts Philharmonia are again at St Saviour's Church on Sandpit Lane in St Albans, and they too are doing sort of seasidey things.
Yes, they've called their concert the English Countryside and Seaside, and it features Elgar's In the South and Sea Pictures and Vaughan Williams' Pastoral Symphony. Elgar wrote In the South as a concert overture or a tone poem while on holiday with his family in Alassio on the Italian Riviera. He described its composition as he was, you know, sort of wandering about enjoying life. And then he says, "In a flash it came to me, the conflict of armies on that very spot long ago where I now stood, the contrast of the ruin and the shepherd. And then all of a sudden I came back to reality. In that time I had composed the overture. The rest was merely writing it down." It's extraordinary. I mean, the piece lasts about 20 minutes. I've only heard a story like that from Mozart, apparently, who sort of composed pieces
in
his head, and then, you know, the long time was writing them down.
Got it. I mean, it's the idea that you could remember in your head something that's 20 minutes
it
long.
It is extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, the next thing is the Sea Pictures, Opus 37, which is a song cycle for mezzo-soprano and orchestra, setting the poems of five different poets, including Alice, his wife, and all on the subject of the sea. It was first conceived for soprano, but Elgar was persuaded to put it down in pitch at the request of the contralto Clara Butt, who gave the first performance, would you believe, dressed as a mermaid.
Right.
They are very popular. They're a very popular part of the mezzo repertoire and have been sung and recorded by Janet Maker, among many others. Now, Vaughan Williams' third symphony, The Pastoral, was written in 1922, and is often misunderstood, as it really isn't a pastoral symphony at all, but the composer's reflections on the horrors of the First World War, in which he himself was an ambulance driver. Sir Roger Norrington describes the four movements as four seasons, starting with summer, but the trumpeter, who is heard in the second movement, you know will soon be dead, and the soprano, who appears only in the very last movement, who is presumably his lover, knows that she will not see him again. So it's a sort of elegy for all those who died, a very moving and beautiful symphony. And here's just the very beginning of the first movement.
That sounds a lovely lineup too, doesn't it? Saturday, the 19th of October, including the Vaughan Williams Pastoral Symphony, the concert by the Harts Philharmonia will be at St Saviour's Church in St Albans on Sandpit Lane, starting at 7:30.
That's right.
Then Saturday the 19th is also the day, so we've got two concerts on that night, for Hertfordshire Chorus's performance. They'll be in the Cathedral at 7:30.
Under their conductor David Temple, they're singing Mendelssohn's great oratorio Elijah, a dramatic version in music of the Old Testament story about the prophet Elijah and his contest with the priests of Baal. It is deservedly one of the most popular choral works regularly performed in this country, a favourite with both choruses and audiences.
And then lastly, today, a mention for St Albans Chamber Opera Company. They'll be performing at the Abbey Theatre Studio at 8 o'clock on Thursday the 24th and on Friday the 25th of October.
Right.
What are they doing?
They're doing a piece called The Bosun's Mate by Ethel Smythe. Another musical offering with a nautical theme.
Mm.
Ethel Smythe was a composer and member of the women's suffrage movement and the first female composer to be granted a damehood. On her 75th birthday in 1934, there was a festival of her music, arranged by Sir Thomas Beecham, culminating in a concert in the Albert Hall in the presence of the Queen, and conducted by Sir Thomas Beecham, who was a great promoter of her work. Tragically, at this moment of final recognition, she was completely deaf and so could hear neither her own music nor the adulation of the crowds. Very sad.
Oh, dear.
Anyway, her one-act opera, The Bosun's Mate, which St Albans Chamber Opera is performing in the Abbey Theatre Studio, was described by one critic as one of the merriest, most tuneful and delightful comic operas ever put on stage. The story is about the battle of the sexes and concerns a feisty and resourceful heroine who outwits her scheming suitor. It was her fourth opera and has been described as feminist. It uses folk songs and Smythe's own March of the Women in its material. The first performance was at the Shaftesbury Theatre in London, and Beecham had arranged for it to be conducted by Eugene Goossens. But on the day, the composer decided that she was going to conduct it. Beecham was very annoyed as he had taken all the preliminary orchestral rehearsals. At the last moment, he wrote, she took over the baton, thinking herself the heaven-sent conductor. She was not. So he was not very happy about it. Anyway, it'll be a jolly evening and continues our nautical theme. And here is a little taster, is the overture, played not in an orchestra, but as this performance will be accompanied on the piano.
Ethel Smythe's The Bosun's Mate. I've never heard of that before. Yes.
No, not very often done.
So that's Thursday the 24th and Friday the 25th of October. St Albans Chamber Opera Company are performing at the Abbey Theatre Studio starting 8 o'clock on both evenings.
Yep.
So quite a lineup for September and October.
Yes, great start to the season.
It is indeed. Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
Finally, we have our piece of music, The Blackbird by Gothby, in its entirety. Thank you. Many thanks to Anna, Marion, Elaine and Jean, our readers today. To Angela, who provided the radio listings, and to Monty and John, who make all the copies of the programme and arrange to get yours to you. We'll be back again next month. But that's all from News Extra in September 2019. Goodbye.